In the sermon that I gave last week, we talked about the phrase, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. And we focused on Judges chapter 17 through 21 and the incidents that that illustrated the consequences of that situation of having no king in Israel and of everyone doing that which was right in their own eyes. There literally was no physical king in Israel during the time of the judges, but what happened when Israel received a king? Did it improve the situation? Was there better government? Was the moral condition improved under a king? At times, it would improve. And at times, as you had a king who was unrighteous, it contributed to the unrighteousness of the kingdom. Under a monarch, did everyone cease doing what was right in their own eyes? Were there expectations of the government, were those who were being governed, did they have their expectations met? So what we're going to do today is we're going to examine Israel's demand for a king. We're going to look at God's expectations regarding a king, the consequences of having a physical king, and finally, some lessons in regard to a king. I've entitled the sermon, A King in Israel. The last sermon was, No King, There Was No King in Israel. So we saw in the last sermon that there was a cycle that took place in Israel and takes place among in our lives as well and in the church. It's a cycle of sin, of servitude, of supplication, and salvation. We tend to humanly go through that cycle of sin, servitude, supplication, and salvation. And right now, I think we're in the sin cycle. We've not we have not suffered enough to where we're in the supplication cycle, and so that's going to come. And as we suffer the consequences of our sin, then we will begin to turn to God. We'll begin to say there must be some other answer versus all of the suffering we're going through. And ultimately, God will usher in our salvation. We also saw Israel's deterioration in the area of religion and morality. What we found as we looked at the book of Judges was a degeneration in the home. We found that there was, unfortunately, degeneration in the true religion, a mixing together of paganism and the true religion. And there was also a degeneration in the society as a whole. So what we're going to do today is we're going to take a look at the end of the period of the judges and look at the high priest Eli and also look at Samuel, who was the final judge in Israel, and see some things that were going on then, and some of those things led to the demand for a king. So let's begin in 1 Samuel chapter 2. 1 Samuel chapter 2. And Eli was the high priest at the time. He was a descendant of Aaron, as he well should have been. And but he was of one family. There were two families that were involved here. He was of one family, and the other family eventually supersedes Eli's family a few generations down the line. But we'll see why. First Samuel chapter 2, let's begin in verse 12. Now the sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know the Lord. In their lives, God was not king. They did not know the eternal. They were corrupt. I mean, that's just it's about as blunt as you can put it. And the priest customs, now these were the customs not that God ordained, but these sons of Eli had instituted. And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged flesh hook in his hand while the meat was boiling. So they boiled up the meat, and they could reach in with this three-pronged instrument and pull out the meat, and they got to keep whatever they brought in. And this is how it was done at Shiloh. Shiloh was the place where the tabernacle was established at this particular time in Israel's history. Verse 15, also there they before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who sacrificed, give meat for roasting to the priest, for he will not take boiled meat from you, but raw. Hey, that boiled meat's not satisfactory. We want meat that we can roast. And that's what they came and they demanded of the person coming there to make sacrifice. Verse 16, and if the man said to him, they should really burn the fat first, then you may take as much as your heart desires. He would then answer him, no, but you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force. So this was the situation in the religious practice of the time. There was corruption, and they were doing things that God had never ordained as people came up to make sacrifice. Verse 17, therefore the sin of the young men, that is, the two sons of Eli, was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord. People who came up and willingly came to the Passover and made offering at other times of the year didn't want to come up because of the corruption that was there and the difficulties that they had. So here you have the religious leadership undermining the desire of the people of Israel to practice the true religion. By their practices, they were turning the people off. So people weren't very happy with the way things were going in this regard. Verse 22, so this was going on, and Eli was aware of these problems. And so we come down to verse 22 of chapter 2. Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So not only were they misusing their office to take from the people of God as they made sacrifice, they were also involved in sexual sins right at the tabernacle. So he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgressed. He knew what they were doing and the damage that they were doing. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, which is exactly what they were doing, they were defying God. He said, who will intercede for him? Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father because the Lord desired to kill them. So Eli could have taken care of this because what his sons were doing was outrageous. And unfortunately, he did not intervene to stop them. And really, he should have removed them from office or executed them, because what they were doing was really abominable in God's sight. So he didn't really take care of it in the way that God would wanted it to be taken care of. Verse 26, and the child Samuel grew, so he's growing up and he's maturing, and he's going to be the not a high priest, but a judge in Israel. So Eli's sons were incorrigible. They didn't administer their priestly responsibilities in the manner that was commanded of them, and they committed other sins as well, as we saw, the sexual sins there at the tabernacle, you know, which is really basically, if you're doing this at the tent of the tabernacle, you're doing it right out in the open before God. And God took it seriously. And that's why God desired to kill them, because of what they were doing. And as I said, the people were so disillusioned with this that they said, I'm not going up to sacrifice. So for you to discourage God's people from practicing His way of life, could you do anything that is more outrageous and destructive than that? God actually sent a prophet to Eli to pronounce judgment on him for allowing his sons to conduct themselves in this particular way. And the judgment was to be very severe. He was going to remove him from office. As it says in verse 35, he says, then I will raise up for myself a faithful priest. Obviously, he was telling Eli, you've not been faithful. Who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. I will build him a sure house, and he shall walk before my anointed forever. So God's going to raise up a priest who will be true and faithful. Now, as I said, Samuel is growing up in the household of Eli, and he's learning about the priesthood and all of those kinds of things. He's serving at the tabernacle, but he's not a priest. But he does grow up to be Israel's last judge. But there's going to be somebody that's going to come along and take over the priesthood. And as you go through down further into Israel's history, you come down to the time of Solomon. And the high priest, as Solomon begins his reign, is a priest who's a descendant of Eli by the name of Abiathar. And unfortunately, by his conduct, Solomon removed him from office and established in his place a priest by the name of Zadok. And the descendants of Zadok continued to serve in the high priesthood. And they were faithful to God, and God recognizes their faithfulness by saying that in the time of the temple in the millennial kingdom, the priesthood of Zadok will continue. And so anyway, these are the conditions you find in Israel. And when there's bad government, everybody suffers. And religion was fundamental to Israel. And when the religion is corrupted, that's really a bad thing for the people of God. So as we move on in the history of this, we come to 1 Samuel chapter 4 when something rather dramatic takes place. The Israelites felt that they were basically invincible because they had the Ark of the Covenant. If you recollected, when Israel came into the land of Canaan, they had the priest go before them with the Ark of the Covenant, and as they came, they stepped into the waters. The waters stopped, and a dry path was made for Israel to walk across the Jordan River into the land. And just as God had allowed them to pass dry shod through the Red Sea, God allowed them to cross the Jordan, and everybody knew it. And basically, when they had heard the stories about God being with Israel, it broke the will of the Canaanites to resist in many cases. So, but the thing was, the Israelites developed a superstition about the Ark of the Covenant. And basically, their belief was, if the Ark of the Covenant is here with us, we're invincible. It really doesn't matter about our conduct. All that matters is that we have the magic box with us. And if we have the magic box, we're going to win. That was their thinking. So they thought that if they had that tabernacle with them, or not the tabernacle, but the Ark of the Covenant with them, they would automatically have God's help. And God was determined to teach them a lesson about this particular situation. And they went to battle against the Philistines in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And they thought that they would defeat them. And as they had been fighting the Philistines, there were several stages to the battle, and they had been defeated. And they thought, well, why were we defeated? They said, oh, we didn't have the Ark of the Covenant here with us. So they went up, and they got the Ark of the Covenant, and they brought it into the camp. And when it was brought into the camp, there's a huge shout among the people of Israel that the Ark of the Covenant was there. And the Philistines heard the shout. And they thought, uh-oh. Something significant's happened because they're over there in the other camp shouting, so something big's happening over there. And I'm sure they became aware that the Ark of the Covenant had been brought into their midst. And I think that they were afraid of what the outcome would be. But basically, their leaders told them, it doesn't matter whether it's over there or not. You basically are fighting for your life here, whether the Ark of the Covenant is over there or not. So you better do everything you can to win, because that's the only hope we have. And they actually ended up defeating Israel and killing the two sons of Eli, capturing the Ark of the Covenant, and destroying the tabernacle at Shiloh. So it was a major, major defeat. Let's go back to Psalm chapter 78, which talks about this defeat. It was a significant thing that took place in Israel. Psalm 78, beginning in verse 56. Psalm 78, verse 56. Speaking of Israel in general and the general approach that they had, verse 56, yet they tested and provoked the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned back and acted unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their carved images. When God heard this, he was furious and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent he had placed among men. And he was telling them, it really doesn't matter that the tabernacle is in your midst. It doesn't matter that the Ark of the Covenant is in your midst if you are not living the way that goes along with that. Just because you have this building, this movable temple in your midst, my dwelling place in your midst, and you have the Ark of the Covenant, doesn't matter. And it's a lesson for all of us. It doesn't matter if you're there where the temple is, because they began to believe if the temple was, they were there where the temple was, that they were safe and they would never fall. And we sometimes have the same belief. We're in a particular organization, therefore it doesn't matter how I conduct myself. I'm in the right place. And it's similar thinking. So he allowed the tabernacle to be destroyed, and the two sons of the high priest to be killed. And it was a very devastating thing to the people of Israel. And they lost the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant, and it took some time to get it back. So, and what happened here as a result of this, we have Eli, as they came and gave him the report about the battle, that he died. That he fell back and died. And also his daughter-in-law, she was pregnant, and she died, and as well, she died in a grief-induced labor. And so it was a very tragic time. With the death of Eli, Samuel took over all the duties as judge, and he's never mentioned in connection with Shiloh again. Instead, he made a circuit to various cities, Bethel being one of them, and his own dwelling place was in the town of Ramah. So Shiloh's abandonment is brought out by Jeremiah as a most a bad time in the nation of Israel. Let's look at just one passage in that regard in Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7. Verse 12. Now these were God's people. And you know, it should be a lesson, you know, to all of us that we can be God's people, but if we're not living as God's people, if God is not king in Israel, then the same fate can await us. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 12, it says, "But go now to my place which is in Shiloh." Go to Shiloh. Go to Shiloh, where I set my name at the first. It's where the tabernacle was at first, and see what I did to it. It's gone. It's gone because of the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because you have done all these works, says the Lord, and I spoke to you, rising up early and speaking, but you did not hear, and I called you, but you did not answer. Therefore I will do to the house which is called by not my name. He's speaking of the temple here. And he's saying, I'll do the same thing to the temple that I did to the tabernacle if you do not change the path that you're on. Which is called by not my name, in which you trust, into this place which I gave to you and your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. So God is telling them here through Jeremiah the prophet that if you continue on this path, there will be consequences. And as we look at our nation, we're on a path. We're sowing the wind, and ultimately we're going to reap the whirlwind. So you come through this period of time, and you see the difficulties that they're facing as Eli is the he dies, and then Samuel takes over, and they continue to have challenges along the way. Now they have some successes under Samuel because Samuel was a righteous judge. About 20 years after the capturing of the ark, the Israelites began to seek God again in relief from the Philistines. So they've sinned. They've been taken captive, and now they're supplicating God, and God is going to intervene on their behalf. So Samuel gathered them together at a place called Mizpah, about 2 miles north of his home in Ramah. And here Samuel leads them in pouring out water to God, which is evidently a symbolic of one pouring out one's heart in repentance to God. The gathering incites the Philistines to attack. So they see the people of Israel gathering together here, and they attack. But the Israelites are in a particularly God-oriented frame of mind, and following Samuel's preaching, God grants them victory. And you know, really, if you go back and you examine what takes place there, you find that they really didn't do a lot of fighting. They didn't win because of their might and power. The Philistines were coming after them and going to attack them, and God miraculously caused the thunder and to be loud and caused disarray among the Philistines and turned the battle in Israel's direction. And basically, Israel just had to clean up after God had set the Philistines in disarray. So, as Samuel got older, Israel's faith began to waver again. And one of the reasons that they began to waver is because Samuel's sons, who were helping him in his duties and responsibilities as judge, were unrighteous. The people, or at least the elders, began to be worried about what would happen to them after Samuel died. They thought, oh no, these guys could be in charge, and we don't want that. And that they decided that what they really needed was a human king. They needed a human king like those ruling and leading the nations around them. And God has, you know, goes through a process of you speaking with Samuel and having Samuel tell them what the outcome of having a human king would be. You know, you want a human king. You think this is the solution, but is it really? Is it really the solution? And, you know, as you look at it in a modern context, you have people that believe that re-electing the president is going to be the best thing for the country, and that's going to take care of all their problems. And you have people that are the diehards and support that particular position, and you have the other people that say, well, Romney's the guy, or whoever it may be. And the thing is, it doesn't matter whether it's President Romney or President Obama, it's not going to get any better, because there's no turning to God. And a president doesn't change human hearts. Now, he can help. He can point you in the right direction by just and honest rule, but he's not going to turn all those hearts around. So, when the elders asked to have a king like all the nations around them, they were forgetting that Israel's strength was to be unlike the other nations. And the path that we are on as a country is to be like the other nations. America is unique. It's had a unique constitution and a unique form of government, and we are rejecting that in order to adopt the governmental pattern of the world around us. And does not bode well for the people of the United States. But that's typical of different countries. You have a point where you're on the right track and you have certain foundational principles, and almost inevitably nations fall because they leave those founding principles. And that's what we are in the process of doing. So anyway, you have they want to be like all the other nations, and the elders were concerned about national security and protection from the enemies around them. Yeah, the Philistines were still a powerful nation, and the Ammonites were still a threat. And Israel had no standing army. They didn't have a standing army. And they had no king to lead it. But they thought, you know what, if we have a king and a standing army, then we'll be safe. Is that true? The elders forgot that it was the Eternal who was to be their king. It was the Eternal that gave them the victory. As you look at the victory that they had in Samuel's time against the Philistines, it did not come because they had a standing army or king. It came because God gave them the victory. But that point, they completely missed that point. Completely missed it. But they unfortunately wanted a king. But they missed the most fundamental point, and that is that Israel already had a king. They had a king ever since the time of Moses and the Exodus. From the time of around 1450 BC, when Israel became a true nation, the king at that time, and for nearly 400 years, was the Rock of Israel. He was their king. Moses wasn't their king. Moses, in essence, was a viceroy, a vice king, and ruled under God's leadership. The king was the rock of Israel. You know, as you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 4, it talks about the rock of Israel. And as you go forward into the New Testament, it says, and that rock was Christ. He was their king. He was there with them. He was the one that would give them the victory. He was the one that would guide them and direct them if they were willing to listen. Though ruling through his chosen judges from Moses and Joshua all the way to Samuel, God, in the person of Jesus Christ, sat on the throne of Israel. Let's go back to Judges chapter 8 and look at something that is interesting about even some of the judges recognize this. In fact, the judge here, Gideon, it's interesting what he says. Judges chapter 8, verse 22. Judges chapter 8, verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your sons. Be our king. Begin a dynasty. And your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." Yes, God has given you victory, so be our king. And what does Gideon respond? But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." Because the Lord, or the Eternal, is king. And, you know, if that were the case in our country, you wouldn't have to have a standing army. You wouldn't have to have a standing army because God would watch over and protect you. Samuel later tells the Israelites that the period of the judges was a time in which the Lord your God was your king. He tells them that in 1 Samuel 12, verse 12. And it's the reason that when the Israelites told Samuel around 1050 B.C. that they wanted a human king like the other nations, the Lord told him, "They have not rejected you." They've not rejected you. See, Samuel took it personally. But God said, "They're not rejecting you. But they have rejected me that I should not reign over them. They don't want to do it my way. They don't want to live according to my laws and statutes and judgments. They want a human monarch." So God said, "Okay, I'll give you a king." It's an interesting perspective that you might think about here is why, if you go back to Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, it says there that the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. So if the king in Israel is to be from Judah, why was the first king from Benjamin? Have you ever thought about that? Why was the first king from Benjamin? Now, this is an explanation of that which I found to be interesting. Could part of Israel's sin in requesting a king be in their insisting God give them a king immediately? "We want a king now. Samuel, you're old, and we don't want your sons to rule over us. We want a king now." And so God had a king in mind for them. Could it be that God had David in mind to be their king? He was from the nation of Judah. And at the right time, in the right place, God would establish him as king. But the time was not right. But they want a king immediately. So the Lord gave them their request by appointing Saul to be king, and he used Saul to chasten the nation and prepare them for David, the man of his choice. As you think about that particular perspective, maybe we're getting the leaders we deserve. So when the Christ comes, that descendant of David who eventually takes the throne will say, "Whew, I'm sure glad that's over, because we've had some bad leaders. And I don't think it's going to get better, unfortunately. The fact that Israel was from the tribe of Benjamin and not Judah is evidence enough that he was never expected to establish a dynasty in Israel. Now, if Saul had turned out to be a righteous king, I think God would have blessed him and his house. But he did not turn out to be such a king. Hosea chapter 13, verse 11 in the New International Version says this about Saul being king. He says, "So in my anger, I gave you a king, and in my wrath, I took him away." Their demand for a king caused God to be angry. So he gave them a king, and in his wrath, he took him away. Something interesting here about, you know, how many of you have felt disappointed? You've prayed to God and had certain expectations and wanted God to give you something, and God didn't do it. We've probably all had that experience where God has said no. But this is interesting in Psalm 106, verses 13 through 15. Psalm 106, verses 13 through 15. Sometimes we want something, and we want it, and God says no, but we persist in our desire for it, and God ultimately gives it to us. And sometimes it's not always what we want to work out. Psalm 106, verse 13, it says, "They soon forgot his works. They did not wait for his counsel." Maybe what they were requesting was something that God would allow them at some point, but the timing wasn't right, such as having a king. "They did not wait for his counsel, but lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tested God in the desert, and he gave them their request." He gave them their request. Oh boy, God has blessed us by giving us our request. But look what it says at the end of verse 15. "But sent leanness into our soul," their soul. So it really didn't turn out to be a blessing. He gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. In the long run, it really wasn't a blessing. And sometimes the greatest judgment that God can give us is to let us have our own way. That's how we'll learn the lesson the best. The Eternal wanted his people to go into this new venture with their eyes open. So God commanded Samuel, say, look, let's tell them, you know, that you want this. Let me tell you what the outcome's going to be. So Samuel begins to go through what a king's going to do to them and for them. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 8. That's where Samuel goes through the downside of having a king. He tells them there are going to be certain consequences in 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 22. 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 22. So beginning in verse 10, he says, "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you." This is going to be the way that he will act. Verse 11, "He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots." So he's going to use them as his men of war. And yes, they may be riding in glorious chariots, but people that ride in glorious chariots also die glorious deaths. A lot of grief involved with that. "He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties." So he's going to take your children and he's going to send them, train them in his army, and he's going to use them in his armed forces, and he's going to send them out for all sorts of battles, sometimes at his own whim. "He will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest." So he's going to use them as his servants to plow his ground and reap his harvest. "And some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants." So I'm going to take this fifth prime, 50 acres, and I'm going to give you those 50 acres to the commander of my army. And I'm going to give your land to this guy because he does this for me. And you have to realize, how did the king have the authority to do that? Under God's law, he didn't. But once you become a despot, you can do anything you want. And he's basically telling them that these kings will become despots. He goes on to say, he will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. This will be the outcome of this choice. You get to choose. So realize this is how it's going to work out. You sure you want to do that? And so Samuel lays that all out for them. And in verse 19, it says, "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, 'No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" So you're giving up some of the good things that God has given you, your freedoms, and the blessings that God has given to you for what you think is going to make your life better and more secure. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed their voice, make them a king. Give them what they want." So God did give them a king. Unlike other ancient rulers, interestingly, the king of Israel was never to be an absolute monarch, a despot. That was never to be the case. God has Samuel appoint Saul as commander. And he's appointed to that position in 1 Samuel 9, verse 16. And he's called there a captain or commander. And the word there in the Hebrew means a viceroy, a vice king. So he was not the king and that he was supreme. He was under God. He was answerable to God always. And his responsibility was to be God's representative, and he was to report back to God. In fact, the very act of anointing a ruler in the ancient world implied a vassal relationship. He was God's vassal. And it's later explained that Israel's king sat on the throne of the Lord. Look at how it's stated in 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 23. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 23. And Solomon has been anointed king, and this is what it states about him being king. It says, "Then Solomon sat on the throne of the Lord. He sat on the throne of the Lord as king instead of David his father and prospered, and all Israel obeyed him." So he was God's servant. He was God's vassal, and he was to rule under God, with God as his advisor, and he was answerable to God. Also, it's interesting, as you look at the kings of Israel, they were not priests. They were not priests. They were kings. And in other nations, kings made law and were thus above it. But in Israel, God's prophet Samuel will explain the rights and duties of the kingship. There were rights and there were duties. And the ruler was subject to the law, as we'll see here in Deuteronomy chapter 17. What God was essentially setting up was a constitutional limited monarchy, and in which he would send a prophet as his representative to give the king his report card. So you would have prophets come to the king and say, "You're not cutting it." And most of them say, "I don't care." A few of them heeded and turned things around. But he was the prophets were sent to give them a report card about how they were doing. And as you look at the Israelite kings, they didn't make the laws. The laws were already made. They were subject to the law, and they were to enforce and uphold the law. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 17, which talks about kings. And the thing that you have to realize about whether you had judges or you had a king, if you accepted that God was king in Israel and the overall ruler of everything, and you had a judge or you had a monarch or what elders or whatever it may have been, just like in our time, that all could have worked. It all could have worked. God was saying, okay, we can work this. If you want a king, we'll have a king. But it can work according to my way of doing things, if the king will be responsible to me and conduct himself in a way that is pleasing to me. It'll all work governmentally. So it doesn't matter what you have. A king, one guy, 12 guys, 15 guys. It doesn't matter as long as it's done in a godly fashion. But let's look at what God stipulated as far as the kings are concerned. Deuteronomy chapter 17. You think about when this is included in the book of Deuteronomy. The books of Deuteronomy were written by Moses. There was no king in Israel in Moses' time other than God. There was no physical king. So somebody had to have written these things down and put them into the book of Moses, or maybe God inspired Moses to write them in his time, knowing that in time there would be a king. Because in Genesis it does tell you that the scepter will not depart from Judah. So when the kingship is established, there will be a king, obviously, and these are the rules that are to guide him. So God inspired it one way or the other. But in Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, he explains what the duties and responsibilities and expectations of a king are. Verse 14, when you come to the land, so as you come into the land that I have promised you to receive, which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it, and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations are around me. Okay, when you come to that point and you want a king, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. So who's to be your king? The one the people choose or the one God chooses? The one God chooses is to be your king. One from among, and you know, would you rather have God choose or would you rather vote and elect him? How many people have voted for the wrong guy? And trust me, I learned this in high school. People do not vote for the best person. Because I knew some of the people that were running for office, and in one particular situation, there was a friend of mine who was highly intelligent, eventually went to West Point. He was the most capable person to be president of the Associated Student Body at my high school. And there was a young lady that was also well qualified. But who do the people elect? They elect the party guy, Mr. Party, that everybody loves and is fun and all of this, but he's just a big goof off and he's the guy they elected. And trust me, they're still doing that as adults. I mean, it's not changed. That's the world we live in. People don't elect the best person in many cases. And unfortunately, we, the governed, pay the price in that because we can't. And many times, you don't see people. Do you think those commercials that point out that this guy loves horses and he's there with his family, that's a true picture of the person running for office? How many of you know them? I don't know them. I hear a name. I hear good things about them, but I don't know them. And that's part of the problem. God knows them. And God knows their hearts. That's why the government of God is going to work, because God knows who's going to rule. And he's developing the people that he's going to put into those offices. So when they're put into those offices, they will rule like he stipulates here. So he says here that he says, and you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. That's who we want to rule, one that God would choose. One from among your brethren. So you shall set as king over you. One who comes from your culture, your society, your religious background. One who is your family. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. The reason you would not set a foreigner over you is not because they were a foreigner, but because they were not religiously different from you. It's a matter of religion. And your religion is fundamental to his being a successful king. It says in verse 16, "But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses." So he's telling them that the king is to rule and he's not to build up his army. Returning to Egypt for horses and multiplying horses is all about building the army. And what's the problem with that? When you build the army, on whom are you dependent? God? Or are you dependent upon your military? So once you begin to build up your military, basically you're saying, I'm no longer dependent upon God. I've got a great army, horses, chariots, spears, best weapons, best army. We can defeat anybody. And instead of depending on God, who is the one who's going to give you victory. And that's something that you would easily lose sight of once you began to multiply horses. And you went to Egypt because the best horses of the time were found in Egypt. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives for himself. Why would a king multiply wives for himself? Primarily for political alliances. So when you enter into political alliances, you have to compromise in some way with your neighbors in order to make this alliance. We want something, you want something. Don't do that. And you're also bringing in wives from other nations who differ from you religiously. You don't think they're going to influence you? Don't do that. Don't multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. He shouldn't be. You know, wealth is not the focus of his office. And usually for him to accumulate wealth meant he was oppressing somebody, taking advantage of somebody in order to acquire that wealth. Now maybe God would bless him as he did Solomon. But many times, as you look at the prophets, they mention how the kings and the leaders in Israel were oppressing the people. He goes on to say that also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. So he was to write his own personal copy of the Old Testament. What existed in his time. Write it all down. And so you're to write that copy. And you know, when you write it down, you do remember it more than if you just have the book handed to you. So his own personal copy. And it shall be with him. It's something that he was to have with him. And he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of his law and these statutes. He was to read it every day. You might think about that in light of the fact that you are to be a king. You don't think that applies to all of us as well? And the outcome of reading it every day and focusing upon it and dwelling upon it is to learn to fear the Lord your God and be careful to observe all his words. These things apply to me and they apply to the nation, and it's my responsibility to make sure these things are carried out in our nation. And as you read the words of God's law, there to be a corrective device, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandments to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. The law was to be his guide, was to be fundamental to his kingship, and as a result of that, then it would be a blessing to him and to the nation. A couple of interesting comments that I thought were interesting about some of the things that are mentioned here come from a couple of commentaries that I thought I would read here briefly, because they, I think, do help us to gain a perspective of what God is getting across here. From the Bible Exposition Commentary, the Old Testament, it says, Israel's king must also put his full trust in the Lord and not depend on horses and armies. Foreign alliances based on marriage or material wealth. King Solomon violated all three of these regulations, and it led him and the nation into sin. He married an Egyptian princess, the first political alliances he made by taking first of many political alliances he made by taking foreign wives. Did they eventually corrupt him? Did he eventually give in to their entreaties about God? He did. And it hurt him, and it hurt the nation. He went back to Egypt, not only for a wife, but also for horses, for his army, and built chariot cities in Israel where he stabled his horses and chariots. And he had fabulous wealth, and he came to depend upon these alliances, his army, and his wealth more than he did God. Did Solomon make it into God's kingdom? Maybe. As you look at the book of Ecclesiastes, it may give us some idea that maybe he turned it around by the end. Another commentary, the Bible Knowledge Commentary, has this to say about these things. It says, three things about the behavior of the kings were singled out. The prohibition against acquiring great numbers of horses meant that, on human terms, the king's army, composed mainly of infantry, would be significantly weaker than an enemy's army with many chariots and cavalry. Yet this was precisely the point. An obedient Israelite king was to depend not on military strength, but on the Lord alone. God had already demonstrated his ability to crush a superior chariot army. Did he crush that army at the Red Sea? He sure did. Acquiring horses would mean the people would be going to Egypt where many were available. Returning to the nation's former land of slavery was unthinkable. Prohibition against taking many wives was given because many kings married foreign women to form political alliances. If the king followed the Lord, he would not need political alliances. Also, foreign wives would cause his heart to be led astray to worship their idols. Think of Jezebel. How did she impact the kingdom? Not for good. The prohibition against large amounts of silver and gold was intended to keep the king from developing a sense of independence and a lust for material wealth. And all three prohibitions then were designed to reduce the king to the status of a servant, totally dependent on his master, the Lord. The tragedy of ignoring these commands is seen in Solomon, who broke all three of these prohibitions. So we've seen he was to instead to make a copy of the law and keep that law with him and live by it. And that's what we are to do as well. So what are some lessons for us since we're not kings, but what can we learn from this? Why would we choose a leader who is an Israelite? As I said, we would do so because he accepts God as king. He should understand and be part of a culture of which God and his way of life are central. And he is not from a foreign culture which may not know or accept God's way of life. Your king would be a brother, in other words, family. We are not to have reliance upon our power, our money, our looks, our connections, or any other source than God. That's how we're to live our lives, dependent upon God. For a king to rely upon an army or wealth or alliances instead of God is to move away from the right foundation. So we have to examine our foundation. What are we basing our life on? A king is not to multiply wives, and we're to avoid this destructive path as well. So Solomon followed this path, and it was a destructive path for him. And really, the nation began to move away from the right path in Solomon's time. And as we've seen here, the law was to be foundational. It was to be a guide. It was to be a counselor. It would keep him humble. It would keep him from getting off course, and it would bring blessing to him and his family. A king would live by, follow, and promote the rule of law. And as you look at the United States, one of the great blessings that God has given to us is the rule of law. That the law is above men, and we are all answerable to the law. But as you see our nation is moving away from that. And the rule of law is no longer a fundamental part of our nation. It was a blessing that I think God gave to our nation. But when you begin to make judgments because, well, you have this amount of money, or you're in my party, or you're my friend, you've lost sight of the rule of law. The rule of law applies to me, you, everyone. And when you see that as a citizen, you're discouraged. Well, if they don't have to follow the law, why do I? If they're above the law, why shouldn't I be? It's human nature speaking. The bottom line, even when there is a king, it may be that there is no king in Israel. And this is if the king does not recognize the true king and submit to him personally and in his rule over the people of God. And as you look at the kings of Israel, some kings accepted God and followed God, but most of them did not. And the people suffered as a consequence. As you look at our current national situation, I'd like to read from an article that was written in April 12, 2010 by Joseph Farah. And he explains how America fell for the oldest temptation in the book. And that book is the Bible. He begins by quoting with a quote. He says, "The only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. Frederick Hegel didn't get much right in his life, but he was right about that. It's a story as old as the prophet Samuel before David slew Goliath and before Solomon was a twinkle in Bathsheba's eye. The people wanted change. They wanted to be like the other nations presided over by a king. They rejected self-government with accountability directly to God. The Israelites pleaded with Samuel, 'Make us a king to judge us like all the nations.' Samuel was greatly distressed by this popular uprising, so he asked God about it. And here's what God advised Samuel. 'Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them.' God recognized that his special, beloved, disobedient, chosen people didn't appreciate what they had. Probably the freest, safest society on the face of the earth. They were envious of other nations that were ruled by a king. So he was inclined to grant them their wish, but before doing so, he issued a warning to the people about what life would be like under the rulership of an earthly king. He would take their sons for his own purposes, making war, working for his government. He would take their daughters to do his bidding. He would take their property and redistribute it as he saw fit. But the people didn't listen. 'No, but we will still have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles,' they said instead of heeding the warning." Do you get the picture? Not only did the people not understand that the king was going to rip them off and oppress them, they actually thought the king was going to fight their battles for them. Does this sound familiar to us today? Just like the children of Israel who didn't know how good they had it, Americans decided they wanted to be like all the other nations. All those with nationalized health care programs, command and control economies, the rule of men rather than the rule of law. We fell for one of the oldest temptations in the book. That's how we chose our current government. God never wanted us to be ruled by kings, not his people. He wants us to govern ourselves with accountability to him and his laws. And here we are in the current government, subjecting ourselves to the whims of an earthly ruler who doesn't even obey the established laws of the land that give him authority, while he scoffs at God's eternal laws as outdated, anachronistic, homophobic, racist vestiges of a paternalistic, chauvinistic, false deity. Just like the children of Israel, we got our collective wish. It was a costly lesson for the children of Israel, and it will be a costly lesson for us as well. But if we want to learn a lesson from history, we ought to make sure it's the right lesson. It's not about good economic policies. That's really not going to fix it. It's not just about following the law of the land. That's not going to fix it either. It's not just about the will of the people. That's definitely not going to fix it. It's about being set apart, not being like the rest of the world. It's about remembering there is one true God in heaven to whom we are all accountable. That's the fundamental thing that we have to live by, even though the world around us isn't. It's about having no other false gods before us, including the false god of government, generally, and the false gods of men specifically. You can organize, you can protest, you can sign petitions, you can rally, you can vote. All things that Americans can do. But ultimately, there is one solution found in 2 Chronicles chapter 7. Let's go there. 2 Chronicles chapter 7. This is the answer to our problems. And we must heed it, even if the world around us does not, even if our national leaders do not. Second Chronicles chapter 7. Verse 14. 2 Chronicles 7, verse 14. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sins and heal their land. That's the only hope for our nation or any nation to turn it around. It's not going to be done in the voting booth or rallies or any of that. It's not going to happen. It's going to happen because there's a turning to God. A humbling oneself before God. Currently, in looking at our nation, we could say the true king is not in Israel. And that's a sad thing to take note of. But we look at these things and we can see lessons. We can learn the lessons from them and put them into effect in our own lives and respond to them. And as we learn to take these lessons to heart, then we can be ready to serve the world tomorrow as kings and leaders that will show the people that way of righteousness. So hopefully this gives you a better understanding of the time of the judges, and hopefully in your lives there is a king who rules.